I'm going to go ahead and call. You know, some people are a little bit delayed because of the weather, but we're going to go ahead and get started. And I want to thank Paul Beck for coming back today and getting here in a very timely manner. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, and please introduce yourself and make your presentation.
All right. Thank you very much, Chip Clark. I'm Chip Halbach with the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and my presentation today will continue some of your prior presentations, providing some background on the affordable housing issue and needs in the state, and also I'll spend a little bit of time focusing on the role of the federal government in addressing housing needs here in Minnesota and elsewhere. And Chairman Clark, about how long would you want for this presentation?
Just 15 minutes, I think. Will that do? Does that work?
Sure. Okay. Cut me off.
Yeah, we want to let committee members have a chance to answer questions if they might come.
All right. So, and you have hopefully now two handouts. One is a background piece with some of the statistics we've pulled together over from past reports and looking at that were prepared for the Homes for All convention that we and a number of groups hosted last December. And then there's a PowerPoint presentation, and that's what I'll be working off of for this next 15 minutes. So first, continuing with some of the prior presentations, I want to highlight a couple of items that I think are particularly important for this committee. The first one here is that looking at the number of households in Minnesota that are paying over 50% of their income for housing and what's happened to that number in Minnesota. This is one of the, as we look at all of the indicators on affordable housing, paying over 50%, that extreme cost burden is one of the most important statistics. And Minnesota, up to the last couple of years, had been in much better than most other states in the country. But this table is one that points out that that situation is changing in Minnesota very rapidly. In fact, for the last couple of years, Minnesota has the number of households in this state paying over half their income for housing has increased faster in Minnesota by far than in any other state in the country. And the table here shows Minnesota in 2000, there were a little over 6% of households, this is both owners and renters, in the state paying over half their income for housing. By 2005, that had jumped up to nearly 12%, so about 1 in 7 or 1 in 8 households across the state are paying over half their income for housing. That increase between 2000 and 2005 is a little over 80%, and you could see New Hampshire and New Jersey as the next states that have increased are far below what's happened in Minnesota. The following slide just breaks that down in terms of renter household and owner household, and these aren't quite in sync in that this slide goes through 2004, whereas the prior table ran through 2005. But there, the climb has been steady. So first for renter households, you see from 2000 to 2001, there was a
Looks like we're missing the even numbers.
Oh.
And I'm wondering if you have a copy, we could send the page out to have fill in those pages, or does anybody have every page?
Is that true? Everybody's missing the even?
Yep.
Yeah.
Shoot. Okay. So here.
Are you going to be able to make your presentation without it? Or?
Yeah, if you pay attention to the overhead.
Okay.
Bill.
Okay. Thank you.
Sorry. So this next slide then, on the overheads, highlights the difference between renters and owners. With renter households, you see that the big jump was in 2000 to 2001 and then has flattened and is more recently increased. And in 2005, that increases more significantly. And if you realize what's going on, you know in terms of rental rates, particularly in the Twin Cities, that for apartments under $1,000, that they're becoming the vacancy rates are declining and rents are increasing some. So I expect this will march back upward. This bar, ownership has been the most recent, the huge increase in homeowners paying over half their income for housing. And I suspect the committee will spend some time on foreclosures and what's happening in homeowners. But the cost burden, people reaching to achieve home ownership when prices have been increasing, and getting some of these novel mortgage products to be able to get into a home, as you're seeing some of the consequence of that in terms of number of families paying over half their income for housing. There's about 230,000 households across the state in 2005 paying over half their incomes for housing, and that's fairly evenly divided between renters and owners. I want to spend a little bit of time following up on something called the BBC report, and I believe Commissioner Marks may have provided reference to that also in his presentation. Basically, the BBC report prepared by the Minnesota Housing Finance Agency, Family Housing, Greater Minnesota Housing Fund back in 2003, was an effort of the major housing organizations to come together and develop some consensus on what is the need for housing affordability in the state and how that is increasing. And so there are two major numbers that are part of that report. One is how many low-income households are cost-burdened, and this was as of 2000. They relied on the 2000 census, so that was nearly 300,000. And then between, in that decade, which will end 2010, what's the increased need for affordable housing in this state? And they arrived at almost 33,000 units of affordable housing are needed for the increased low-income population. As has been noted a number of times, that this set of estimates does not account for replacement of lost affordable housing, overcrowding, and other factors. So it's a very conservative estimate. Last year, our organization, Minnesota Housing Partnership, took the numbers in the BBC study and said, well, if you took that 33,000 units needed and just evenly divided it across the decade, so about 3,300 units needed per year, what would that cost? How much gap financing money is needed so that the state could keep up with that increased demand? And the conclusion we had was that it would take about $173 million in gap money. That does not include mortgage money or anything. That's the dollars that are needed in the production of ownership and rental housing to bring it down so it's affordable for lower-income households. For the last several years, in our analysis, the state of Minnesota has come up with about 28% of what's required for the production of new affordable housing, 28% of the gap dollars. So 28% of the $173 million is about $48 million per year. And that $48 million per year, or $173 million, that is what is needed in new resources annually. And that also, as it says here, you can read the fine print, and hopefully you'll get the extra copies of these slides soon. That assumes no let-off of existing resources for affordable housing, and that either philanthropic or federal resources or what the private sector is able to do itself. So, again, it's extremely conservative. And I should say we did this report as part of a longer analysis of the potential and need for dedicated resources for housing here in the state. So the report itself, which is on our website, or if we could furnish the committee copies if they would like, it also examines dedicated resources for housing that are used in a number of states, and what are some opportunities in Minnesota. This slide is also taken from that study. There's two major ways that states are able to contribute to the production of affordable housing. One is through their appropriations, and the other is through dedicated sources of revenue for housing, like deed taxes, like here in Minnesota we use interest earnings on real estate escrow accounts. So this state, this table is just to give the committee some idea of how Minnesota stacks up compared to other states that invest in affordable housing. So it's not looking at all states across the country, but the states that are investing. And Minnesota is here in 2004 is by nowhere near the top, but we do pretty well, primarily through appropriated funds. But you can see that Hawaii, Florida, Vermont, California invest quite a bit more in affordable housing, and on a per capita basis. We examined this both on a dollars per capita and also dollars per cost burden resident. Now, as the legislature and others consider what we might want to do in Minnesota to increase resources for housing, I want to provide a little bit of background on what the federal government's role in affordable housing, and that's the next slide here. And it's just, again, as you look at the previous slide, which showed that Minnesota total revenue on an annual basis is about $38 million that's invested in affordable housing. Here, the federal government on an annual basis, or here, this for 2005, is invested in Minnesota alone $456 million. So that's not to say that the dollars invested in Minnesota are not critical. They are. They're very much critical. But also, the role of the federal government is by an order of magnitude of 10, extremely important to what happens in this state and our ability to meet affordable housing needs is what happens at the federal government level. And the categories here are rural development, the low-income housing tax credits, and then the various programs of the Department of Housing and Urban Development. So what's going on with the federal government role in affordable housing? Taking the previous table of these dollar amounts from the various housing programs, and the ones that contribute most to dollars coming to this state for affordable housing community development needs, there's several things going on. First was community development block grants. That is a real staple in rural communities through the Department of Deed and through the local governments here in Twin Cities. Is extremely important to take a comprehensive approach to affordable housing and community development. Well, the federal government has steadily been dropping off in the dollar amount contributions for CDBG. And that 15% is not inflation adjusted. That would be more significant inflation adjusted numbers. Section 8 rental vouchers. There, after a scare in, several years ago, the federal government has caught up to existing vouchers. That is, for the last several years, has fully funded existing vouchers across the state. There's about 30,000 households in Minnesota that rely on Section 8 vouchers. But one of the problems is that because the Section 8 program is market-based, it really allows people to go out into the market with paying 30% of their income and the federal government contributing the rest, that as the rental market tightens, that cost goes up for the federal government. So it really squeezes it. As the federal government tries to watch all of the resources going for HUD, it has a tendency to squeeze out funding for other programs like CDBG and public housing. The next bullet point there is the low-income housing tax credit. That has been really the most stable resource for the development of affordable rental housing. In about 5 years ago, I believe, it became indexed. It's indexed both for population and inflation. And as the prior table showed, the resource value of that is about $80 million per year. That should continue unless, as it says here, the president has been looking at various reforms to the tax program, and his recommendations he got last year would say do away with the low-income housing tax credit program. So that's just a note as something we need to watch. Finally, on this list is public housing. That has been, for the last few years, the biggest problem, the most striking of all of the problems in terms of the federal commitment to its affordable housing. And the next graph provides it really shows well. This is from Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. It shows very well of what's happening with the public housing. This is the operating budget. The federal government provides two major resources for public housing. One is the operating side, what's needed to keep the lights on, to keep the buildings managed well and secure, and then on the capital side, what's required to improve the public housing, which for the most part was built in the 1950s and 60s around here, what's required to keep it in a safe condition. So this chart just looks at the operating side. It's a graph that ranges from 70 to 100% and shows that from 81 through 1993 or so, the federal government was pretty much living up to its commitment to provide the operating funds that are needed to support the public housing. But starting in 95, it gets choppy, and then for the past several years, that commitment has fallen off. So what you're seeing, there's some 20,000 public housing units in Minnesota. They're scattered across over 200 communities. What you're seeing are drop in security, drop in maintenance, and other things that really, to me, is a concern, because the public housing in Minnesota is a real community asset, but without the upkeep of it, you're going to see that it's not working, both for the community and particularly the residents of that housing. So this has been one of the things that we're concerned about most with the federal commitment for housing. Back to community development block grant, because that is so important to communities across the state. Here, the decline in the federal commitment isn't as striking as with public housing operations, but you can see what's going on. And President Bush's budget for 2008 just came out yesterday, so I was able to update this bar chart to show what's where the president's proposal for a block grant in 2008 fits with this tape, with this chart. So again, it's a steady decline in resources for the Community Development Block Grant. And again, this is in nominal dollars. It's not inflation-adjusted dollars. So the drop-off is even more significant if you account for inflation. Couple more notes on the federal commitment for affordable housing. The 2007 budget, we are currently in the federal fiscal year 2007, actually started last October 1st. The basic, because Congress has been unable to pass the budget, a new budget for this year, they've been working on a continuing resolution. That continuing resolution now looks like it will be extended through this whole fiscal year, through September 30th. There are, if that happens because of built-in cost drivers, particularly with Section 8, if Congress does not adjust its budget for those cost drivers and just takes 2006 and applies it forward to the rest of this year, there are several bullet points in terms of the consequence for the state, primarily that Minnesota could lose funding for about 1,000 families. The House of Representatives, however, last week did make the adjustment so that these three notations would not occur. So now the budget is going to the U.S. Senate, and it's up to the Senate to sign on to the House proposal. If it does, then we're in decent shape for this year. We still have this drop-off in public housing funding, but we won't lose Section 8 vouchers. So that's an immediate concern, is to ensure that the federal that the U.S. Senate does adopt the House budget, particularly as it concerns housing. Now, as I mentioned, President Bush's budget did come out yesterday, and here are just some quick notes on some of the things that are in the budget that we will be paying a lot of attention to. There are, the budget itself does drop housing funding about 10% overall, but as you can see from these numbers, there are some gainers and some losers. On the losers, we have community development block grants significantly dropping by another 20%. Public housing capital funding, these are the repair grants, 18%. And this, when I say decline, this is from the what looks like will be adopted in 2007, or the continuing resolution brought forward. Elderly housing, 22% drop off, and lead assistance grants, 23%. There are some increases, the home program, public housing operating, a small increase in homeless assistance grant. In conclusion, with this, I just want back to State Department. For our organization's priorities in working with you this for the remainder of the session are three areas, and where we think that the state can have the most impact on some of these housing needs. First is to use the appropriations budget in three areas: housing production, preservation, and ending homelessness. We support the governor's budget, but would have the legislature look at increasing funding in several areas, particularly in production of affordable housing, if we're going to begin to keep up with that demand that's noted in the BBC study. Second is to ensure that property tax policy supports affordable housing policy of the state. In 2005, the state legislature enacted the 4D, or the low-income rental classification. That was extremely important for ensuring that the existing rental, affordable rental housing inventory was had some tax relief. It reduced the class rate on that housing by about 40%. But a lot of affordable rental housing was left out of the classification, particularly mixed-income projects, which are so important for lower-income communities and others where you don't want to just have a large project with all low-income households. So we think there are some changes that can happen there that would really help that critical resource of housing sustain. And then finally, that we believe that the state dollars must be used at maximum to leverage other investments in affordable housing. There, we encourage, we do endorse something the housing authorities and local governments are supporting, which is to create a matching grant program for local government investments in affordable housing, and also that we want to have the legislature look at a charitable housing tax credit program that would provide a 50% tax credit for businesses and individuals that make a donation to affordable housing. Again, we don't see these as the most significant things that can be done, but would contribute and draw in other resources for affordable housing and encourage businesses to get more engaged in what's needed to help their workers and also the communities in which they operate better provide a range of housing opportunities. Last slide I wanted to just leave you with is something that was produced by Greater Minnesota Housing Fund. And it, what it highlights is that the investment that the state makes in the production of affordable housing not only pays off, of course, in terms of providing decent places for lower-income workers to live, helps children by providing stability so that they can learn in school. If they're located near jobs, can ease transportation problems. But also that because of the taxing that happens in Minnesota with income tax, sales tax, if the state invests dollars in the production of affordable housing, you get a lot of those dollars directly back. This, again, is a financial model on what's happening with dollars invested in affordable homes for sale in rural communities where Greater Minnesota Housing Fund utilizes a $10,000 state grant to help create a home for a low, moderate income family that costs $150,000. And in the production of that home, you get the state gets back sales tax on materials, $3,900 income tax paid on construction workers, some mortgage registry and deed tax. That in taxes that comes back on that $10,000 state investment, $11,940, plus the state invests that in a deferred loan, so when the home is resold, the state gets the $10,000 back. That is one more reason in the state looking at its commitment to affordable housing as an investment, not in other ways. Now, this example only does not work for some of the other important housing programs, such as rental assistance, etc. But just to show you that as the state is out there helping communities, particularly those rural regional economic centers that desperately need more affordable housing in order to sustain their growth, that by investing some dollars in the growth of affordable housing units, the state can get that money back. Now, on average, the state here in the metro area invests more, so the economics don't work exactly the same way. But even on rental housing, where there's a production of rental housing, the state is funding of that will get back 20-30% of the dollars it lays out. So I just encourage the legislature to also look at that aspect of why the investment in affordable housing is a good thing.
Thank you, Mr. Halbeck. Are there questions? We went over time, but your information is so important, and I want to make sure that we got it all on the table.
Apologies.
No, that's okay. It's Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Halbeck, clearly the information you're providing us tells us that affordable housing needs are going up. Federal funding to support housing is going down. If the state is not able to step in and fill that gap, who's there to pick up the ball?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I believe last week Michael Dahl from the Coalition for the Homeless showed some of what happens when the ball is not picked up, and that will happen for a number of families, is that they will bounce around. But beyond that, and what I've been working in this field for 30-some years, what I've seen is that there is a private sector response when the state or federal government there. Unfortunately, that private sector response is what some would call slum housing. It's families doubled up and that. So I think what is important is to know is that there won't be, you know, if the state doesn't step up, there will be a hole there.
Is that Morgan?
Just a follow-up. Do the counties and cities have a mechanism whereby they can fill this hole or help out?
The cities and counties do have mechanisms, and unfortunately, a lot of the local government budgets have been very squeezed, but there a couple of the mechanisms are tax increment financing. A lot of communities use that. Local housing authorities have tax levy authority, and a few of the local governments are also able to bond for housing. So there are some tools that exist at the local government level.
And I'm assuming each of those tools would have to do with the property tax increase.
That ultimately is the primary revenue source of local government. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. And committee members, if you have, is there another question? Oh, Representative Kraft.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had one question because you made reference to one of the solutions might be to provide tax credits for businesses to contribute to the growing need that we have. I'm wondering, one, is there such a program out there right now? Or two, maybe you can speak to what maybe you might be considering in that area.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Representative, there is not a program like that now in Minnesota. I believe there are tax credits that are used for other purposes. Illinois, Connecticut, and a couple of other states provide that type of program. Illinois is the one that we would recommend be used as a model for Minnesota, whereas they provide 50% tax credit basically for donations for affordable housing. A number of employers actually will use that to set up an assistance program for employees so that they can buy homes. But there are a variety of uses that it can go for: rental housing, home ownership, and also production of rental housing, and also as for employees to have damage deposits and to get into homes.
Thank you.
Take one more question, and then we're going to go to that point.
No, not really.
Okay.
Hopefully,
we can squeeze it in here. Representative Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just two real quick ones. The last legislative session raised the minimum wage in Minnesota. First question is, did that help at all in the affordability issue for a significant number of people? Looking at your chart, firefighters, dental sale, retail sales clerks and so way, way down below what is affordable for them to rent. And secondly, are there any mechanisms presently in the state government to assist people who are facing foreclosures, those kinds of things, or are those federal programs?
On the foreclosure, the state of Minnesota does have a very good program, a mortgage foreclosure program, and they use nonprofits located throughout the state. I believe Lutheran Social Services is a big one that provides counseling and other resources to help families to avoid that. And I'm sure you'll hear more testimony on foreclosure and things the state both is currently doing and can be doing in the future. Regarding minimum wage, on an annual basis, the National Low Income Housing Coalition produces a report called Out of Reach, which compares the rental prices in each county across the country and metro area and statewide. And they calculated that for Minnesota, the housing wage, that is what is required on an hourly pay rate for an average family to afford a two-bedroom apartment, is about $14 to $15 per hour, which, of course, is far above minimum wage. But is minimum wage and increases to minimum wage, there are many, many families that have multiple earners in their household. So every bit helps. So I don't want to diminish that, but if you're thinking of a family living off minimum wage with one wage earner, you're not going to reach what's required to pay rent in nearly every community across the state.
And just a comment. The reason I asked that question is I think that is an obvious, you know, statement, and I see politicians proudly proclaiming that they've raised the minimum wage a dollar, or at the national level, $2 in 2 or 3 years. I don't find their efforts particularly noteworthy.
Mr. Hoppeck, I'm wondering if you might give the website for that last reference so that people can look at it up on their own, the National Low Income Housing Coalition's description of affordability according to wages.
Yes. The report can be found at nlihc.org. NLIHC for National Low Income Housing Coalition.org.
Thank you very much. No, members, we could keep Mr. Hallbeck here all day. He's such a wealth of information. But I think we have to hear the rest of the health department's presentation today. We want to do that. I want to urge you, though, to use Mr. Hallbeck and his organization as a resource. And we'll probably see you back here again, I'm sure, as some legislation comes forward.
Thank you very much. And again, I apologize that the handouts were got us halfway there.
We got them taken care of. Okay. The Minnesota Department of Health, I want to welcome you back. And while they're coming forward, if everyone had a chance to look at the minutes, I wonder if Representative Lane has and would like to move them.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let's move to approve the minutes.
Okay. Representative Lane moves to approve the minutes of January 31. Any discussion? If not, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes are thus approved. Welcome to the committee. You'll just introduce yourself, please, and
thank you.
The rest of the time slot here. It's about, looks like 45 minutes, so.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Margaret Kelly with the Department of Health, and our plan today is to finish our budget overview, which includes our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, Community and Family Health, Health Promotion and Chronic Disease, and Administrative Services. You should have handouts in your packet. I've brought more in case you don't. And we will begin on it's page 16 of the handout, our Office of Minority and Multicultural Health, and which with me is Mitchell Davis, director of that office. This office is primarily funded with general fund and TANF funds. TANF funds are temporary assistance for needy families. It's a federal block grant that supports welfare and like services around state government. And Mitchell can, the majority of the funding for this office goes out the door in grants, and Mitchell will walk you through the activities of the office. You'll find the detail on page 17 of the handout.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Davis.
Good morning, Madam Chair and Committee. Assistant Commissioner Kelly has said, my name is Mitchell Davis. I'm the Director of the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health. And over the few short moments, I want to just walk through what the Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is, how we focus on health disparities, and some of the key objectives. The mission for the Minnesota Department of Health is protecting, maintaining, and improving the health of all Minnesotans. And so this office certainly falls right smack in the middle of that mission. We've taken it a step further, along with much work through the community and the agency. And the mission for our office is to strengthen the health and wellness of Minnesota's racial, ethnic, cultural, and tribal populations by engaging diverse populations in health systems, mutual learning, and actions essential for achieving health parity and optimal wellness. The office exists basically to close the gap in health disparities that affects American Indians, tribal nations, and populations of color in Minnesota. Also to improve the health status. This Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative is administered through the Office of Minority and Multicultural Health and focuses on two main goals. Infant mortality and immunizations is the one goal, and then the other disease areas are the second goal. I'm going to focus on the infant mortality and immunizations area first. And that states by the statute, by 2010, decreased by 50% the disparities in mortality rates and adult and child immunization rates for American Indians and populations of color in Minnesota as compared with the rates of whites in the state. The other priority health areas include breast and cervical cancer, cardiovascular disease, diabetes, HIV/AIDS, and sexually transmitted infections, violence and unintentional injuries, and healthy youth development. The objective of the program, this grant program, we have 52 grantees around the state. They raise awareness, they do community education, they work around these areas that I've mentioned earlier. We're in 42 counties in Minnesota, out of Minnesota's 87 counties. The grants also provide much needed resources to improve the health and well-being of these communities. And each of the grantees use various multiple faceted approaches to work through the community dynamics. Also a key thing is to spark public and private health responses, and then to create a context to mobilize community conversations, to connect public and private sector actions, and then work through some strategic thinking through that. As we look over the population, for the state in 1990, population of color in American Indians was at 8%, and the white population was at 92%. In 2000, the population of color in American Indian has grown to 15%, and the white population is 85%. It's continuing, of course, to grow. At 15% represents about 644,000, according to U.S. Census in 2000. The Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative program touches lives about 15%, so that's 96,510, through one-on-one counseling, screening, education, classes, and workshops. I want to say a word or two about the health disparity as well. Many of you have seen the report that has come out every year from the United Foundation, and although Minnesota has long been noted as one of the healthiest in the nation, our minority populations experience much worse health, and certainly in several areas. Overall, we experience shorter lifespans, higher rates of infant mortality, higher incidence of diabetes, heart disease, cancer, and other diseases. So this Eliminating Health Disparities Initiative certainly runs right in smack with the difference with that. How does this initiative benefit all Minnesotans? Health is a powerful self-determinant of self-sufficiency, as some have told me from time to time as I go and visit each of the grantees. A goal that unites all of our communities together. Improved health and the prevention of serious health problems is good for the state's economy and its ability to bounce back in tough times. Healthy families and children and a healthy workforce elevate the fortunes of the entire state. Finally, a healthy population is Minnesota's greatest resource, even in tight budgetary times and even in good times. The health of all Minnesotans is a crucial resource. With that, that concludes my remarks at the Chair Committee.
Questions from committee members? Mr. Davis, I have a question. I was just looking at in the book, and y'all, if you're interested in following this, we're talking about pages 82, 84, 85. And looking at the changes in infant mortality, the key measures.
Yes.
And childhood diseases. I guess if you look at how we're doing, what comment can you make about our progress or lack of progress in some of these areas? I'm thinking of some things you maybe can brag about and others we might say we have made very little progress.
Perhaps your page 84, you know, 32?
Yes.
I'm going to speak on the infant mortality. I was almost an infant mortality statistic. I was 3 pounds when I was born. The nurse was very, very diligent to keep working until I could get a small call. The targets that were set for the infant mortality by 2010 recognizes the disparities. When we started this, looking at the data in 89-93, I look at the first line, American Indians was at 16.2. And as we looked at the data and statistics, we set the target there for 9.5. To say by 2010, we want to hit that target. 1995, we certainly saw some coming down to 13.5. And then currently, we've seen, you can see the downward trend. We're at 9.9 for American Indian infant mortality. Certainly a long way to go if we look at our white majority populations, roughly at 4.8 right now. But certainly we know that we're making that downward slope to do there. On the other hand, the Hispanic, Latino, Asian, they have certainly really made some great strides, 5.9, 6.1 for Latino. African American right now is at 10.2. So we are seeing the trend and heading in the right direction. We're certainly not where we want to be. We want everyone to be at that 4.8. But certainly we know we have more work to do. But that doesn't certainly underscore that we're working diligently around the clock on this.
Mr. Davis, one of the things I'd just like to note is we were provided with your budget trends, I guess, from 2003 in our previous discussion. And I know the commissioner wants to come back and talk about the governor's budget, but I just will note to committee members, and correct me if I'm wrong, there's no increased investment in this whole area by the governor's proposal. And I'm just a little worried, and maybe we'll express the concern that maybe the downward trends that we're seeing because of the increased investment in the past, in fact, major increased investments, is not sustained, where it's just a flat level without even any adjustment for inflation. So I'd like to just register that concern. And maybe when the commissioner comes, we could talk about that. Because if we've got some improvement going, it seems to me we'd want to keep doing what's working. And still, it does seem at least concerned to me that we'd still be willing to settle for double the infant mortality with, for example, American Indians or African Americans as compared to the white population. Just to register that, I guess. Thank you. Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to the testifier, I'm wondering if you can get further statistics on infant mortality in relation to SIDS, sudden infant death, and if those could be broken out per population, if that would be possible.
By populations, by SIDS.
Correct. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And if you can make that available to the whole committee, that'd be great. Thank you. Seth Huntley?
Madam Chair, Mr. Davis, we used to be the the worst state in the country for infant mortality in young black women. How do we rank now? I mean, it looks like there's been some improvement. But do you have state rankings for infant mortality?
Madam Chair, Representative, I have seen some. I don't have those available today, but certainly can make those available. The statistics that you referenced, I know I've heard that around 15, 20 years ago, especially in certain zip codes around the metro. But certainly, certainly we'll follow up and bring more information to you for that.
Thank you. Any other questions? Okay. If you'd like to proceed then.
Yes. Next up, we will have our Community and Family Health Division. And while Janet Olstead is coming to the table, I think I will have you turn to page 12 in your handout, which gives you an overview of the funding for this division. This division has multiple funding sources, and it is primarily funded with federal dollars. Those federal dollars are primarily in our WIC program, Women, Infant, and Children Food Subsidy Food and Nutrition Program, and our Maternal Child Health Block Grant. A small portion of the funds is direct appropriated general fund dollars, and a smaller portion, yet again, is direct appropriated health care access fund dollars. The vast majority of funds in this division, 89%, goes out the door in grants. And with me is Janet Olstead, the Director of Community Family Health.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Olstead.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Janet Olstead. I'm the Interim Division Director of the Division of Community and Family Health. Through partnerships with local, tribal governments, healthcare providers, and community organizations, the Community and Family Health Division works to ensure a coordinated state and local public health infrastructure, works to improve the health status of mothers and children in their families, and works to promote access to health care for vulnerable, underserved, and rural populations. The division has approximately 140 staff. The maternal and child health section within the division works to improve pregnancy outcomes and enhance the health of pregnant and postpartum women and their infants and children and youth. Funding in this particular area supports the section manager in a part-time clerical support. Infant mortality activity supports one FTE, which provides leadership and technical assistance for department activities related to reducing infant mortality. The child and teen checkup is the federal early and periodic screening diagnosis and treatment program, which was established in 1967 as a preventative component of the Medicaid program. In Minnesota, called Child and Teen Checkup, this program provides for the coverage of comprehensive and periodic evaluation of health, developmental and nutrition status, in addition to vision, hearing, and dental screening services to all Medicaid-enrolled children from birth to 21 years of age. Under a contract with the Department of Human Service, this unit is responsible for statewide child and teen checkup education and training of health professionals and technical assistance to public and private child health care providers. MinEnable works with teens 12 to 14, their families, and communities to introduce information on relationships, decision-making, and skill building to resist social and peer pressure, and to help teens postpone sexual activity. The program uses a three-pronged approach, community organizing, developmentally appropriate curriculum, and a statewide public awareness campaign. MinEnable's website, saynotyet.com, gives teens a ways to stay in charge of their lives and to say not yet to sex, and offers adults resources for communication with teens. 23 community grant projects across the state reach over 9,000 youth in 2006. This program was created in 1995 and is funded out of the general fund and receives $2 of every marriage license fee. The home visiting unit provides support to local clinic and tribal health staff for home visiting activities they undertake with federal TANF funding. The unit assists providers in applying best practices to promote the health and well-being of pregnant women and families with infants and young children, and promotes family self-sufficiency. AFSD prevention, the Fetal Alcohol Spectrum Disorder Program, is an FASD is an umbrella term describing the range of effects that can occur to an individual whose mother drank alcohol during pregnancy. AFSD is entirely preventable and results in a lifetime disability. Beginning in fiscal year 2005, MDH began transition of general fund appropriations for FASD to the Minnesota Organization of Fetal Alcohol Syndrome, or MOFAS, which is a statewide organization that focuses solely on the prevention of and intervention with FASD. Funding is used to support community grants, which target coordination of FASD activities at the local level, professional education, public awareness, diagnosis and intervention for individuals affected with the disorder, and support services to their families. The Positive Alternatives Grant Program was passed in the 2005 legislative session and is designed to provide assistance to Minnesota women who are facing an unplanned pregnancy. Currently, 37 organizations throughout the state have been awarded funding on July 1, 2006 to provide a variety of services to pregnant women, including case management, client advocacy services, parenting programs, medical and educational support, and items such as emergency rent vouchers, cribs, and car seats. The Family Planning Special Grant Program has been available in Minnesota for a quarter of a century. This program has helped thousands of low-income women prevent unintended pregnancies. Funds also support a family planning hotline. In 2005, over 100,000 individuals were reached through educational presentations, almost 5,000 hotline calls were answered, and over 27,700 individuals were provided with family planning services. We currently have 42 grantees. Family planning grants in Greater Minnesota. The 2005 legislature directed $500,000 a year to family planning clinics serving outstate Minnesota that were experiencing financial need. A total of 15 FPSP grantees received additional funding this past biennium. Newborn screening follow-up. This activity is funded by a portion of the newborn screening fee. Funding supports staff that are responsible for follow-up of newly diagnosed infants identified through newborn blood spot screening. Primary responsibility is to ensure that families are connected with their primary care physician, specialty clinics, and other available resources necessary for appropriate support and treatment. Promoting perinatal health. This is one-time funding to provide upfront support to the department in making videos available to hospitals on shaken baby syndrome. Going on to Minnesota Children with Special Health Needs Clinic Program, which provides comprehensive evaluations to children through regional specialty clinics held in Greater Minnesota. Approximately 600 children are seen annually in either facial dental clinics, developmental and behavior clinics, diabetes clinics, or rehabilitation and technology clinics. Specialists provide assessments, diagnosis, and plan of care for each child seen within their local community. In the Office of Public Health Practice, this section provides coordination, leadership, and support to the 53 community health boards so Minnesota's local public health system can respond effectively to a range of public health issues. Staff also provide grant oversight, administrative, and operational support, including reporting requirements for the Local Public Health Act. Local Public Health Act funding provides funds to Minnesota's 53 community health boards to carry out local public health responsibilities within a system of statewide guidelines and standards. Funding is distributed through a formula, and community health boards are required to match $3 for every $4 in state funds received. The purpose of the Indian Health Grants is to provide health service assistance to Native Americans who reside off reservations. There are currently 5 grantees. The Migrant Health Grant supports health services to migrant workers and their families, and there's 1 statewide grantee. The Office of Rural Health and Primary Care promotes access to quality health care for rural and underserved urban Minnesota. This area includes staff that manages the office's grant programs, conducts research on rural health issues, keeps rural stakeholders informed, and works with rural providers and rural communities to stabilize the rural health care safety net. The office manages an average of 175 rural hospital, clinic, and pharmacy grantees. The office supports the Rural Health Advisory Committee and produces regular reports and studies on rural health issues. The statewide trauma system's goal is to ensure that severely injured people are promptly transported and treated at trauma hospitals appropriate to the severity of their injury. Staff assist hospitals in applying for trauma center designation, designate trauma hospitals, and operate a web-based trauma registry for trauma information. Staff also support the State Trauma Advisory Committee. The Workforce Development, the Workforce Analysis Program, collects practice data on approximately 100,000 health professionals. The program analyzes workforce characteristics and trends, and the program's reports are widely used for workforce planning. This area also contains the Loan Forgiveness Program, through which an average of 215 health providers are serving rural and underserved communities. The office also coordinates placement of foreign physicians who agree to practice in rural and underserved areas. An average of 120 foreign physicians serve these communities. The Summer Internship Program and the Health and Long-Term Care Careers Program support health careers experiences for over 300 students each summer and assist school districts and employers to offer health care career courses. The Rural Hospital Capital Improvement Grants. This program provides an average of 20 to 25 capital improvement grants and 15 planning grants each year to small rural hospitals to plan and conduct capital improvement and other essential projects. Grants are used to update, remodel, or replace aging hospital facilities and equipment necessary to maintain the operations of a small rural hospital. Rural hospitals with 50 or fewer beds are eligible, and we currently have 21 grantees. The Community Clinic Grant Program provides an average of 15 grants each year to community clinics serving low-income and uninsured patients. Grants support clinical capacity to serve people with low incomes, reduce current or future uncompensated care burden, or improve care delivery infrastructure. The Community and Family Health Management includes overall management of the six sections within the Division of Community and Family Health, as well as division-wide services such as computer, financial, and clerical supports. It provides oversight for the MCH task force activities and includes the department's responsibilities in printing and mailing of the Women's Right to Know information materials. And I think that has covered the budget for the Division of Community and Family Health.
Other questions from committee members? Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the Local Public Health Act funding. Can you expound a little bit on the expenditures for that? It's a significant amount, and I was just curious as to what the program entailed.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, the Local Public Health Act funding is all goes out the door in grants to community health boards. Back in 1976, we consolidated from over 1,000 local boards of health to 53 community health boards that are primarily at the county level. Some are at the city level. Some are consolidations of counties and cities. And we provide $21 million of general fund resources with the additional federal resources out to local boards of health for them to carry out the responsibilities that are outlined in the Local Public Health Act. Much of local public health happens at the local level.
Madam Chair, and I'm curious, then, the counties have the opportunity to write for grants for this, or is distributed via director of those 53 agencies, or...
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, we allocate it out to counties based on a formula that looks at population and a few other factors, but primarily population of the county. So it's purely formula-driven. There are other grants in the department that counties do apply for, compete for competitive grants for counties, but not all counties apply for those. But this provides the base funding for public health activities at the local level.
Madam Chair, just one more follow-up. If you wouldn't mind, if I could get a little more information on that particular program, I would appreciate a handout on that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
As a matter of fact, before we go to the next question, I just wanted to ask, checking the budget book, there are many of the programs that you went through today that do not have a budget page that describes the program in any of the detail, at least as far as I have them. We are in the dark if people are new at this to this division. So I would like to maybe ask you to meet with a staff and figure out why we don't have those budget pages and see if we can't remedy that for the next hearing by the time the commissioner comes. That would be very helpful. We have, you know, we have this document and we have the biennial budget, but there are many programs that are not listed in here. For example, if I wanted to compare the Enable program, which is in the book, to the family planning special project grants, there's no description to compare it to. And that's just one example. I mean, there are a whole host here that I think would be very helpful for this. Committee members to be able to have access to.
Madam Chair, we'd be happy to work with your staff to see what information we can provide. We put together the budget document following guidance provided by the Department of Finance, which asks agencies to put together the narrative description of their activity at a very high level. And so you're right, you don't have in narrative form all the detail that I think you're looking for. We probably have that in some way or another at the department and can find out what you need and pull that together for you.
I think that would be very helpful because this committee is going to be probably pinching every penny we can, and we need to know, you know, what programs we're looking at. Representative Madour.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question about the family planning special project grants, and what I heard you said in your presentation was that 27,000 women have been served, and basically they come to you with an unplanned pregnancy and you give them a crib and a car seat and some rent vouchers. And then what I didn't hear from you is referrals to other programs, what you do after the age of two when they no longer qualify for MA, which I'm assuming that's the first referral that you make to them to get them health care. And then at the age of two, the child and the parent are kicked off of the program. So what follow-ups do you do with the family after the age of two? Is there a continuum of services that are part of this service grant? And then following that, as far as the rent vouchers go, what exactly does that mean? Is it just for the duration of the pregnancy? Does it follow the child till age two when they're enrolled in the MA programs? I'm a bit confused because, frankly, a crib and a car seat is very short-term thinking on how to take care of the child for the rest of their lives. So what is the plan for that? And I didn't see it in the book, and if it is there, I apologize in advance for seeing that.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the 27,700 was the number of women that we're currently serving under our family planning program, which is providing pre-pregnancy family planning contraceptive services.
Okay.
Some of the other things that you were discussing really fall within our Positive Alternatives grant program. This is a new grant program. It's in its first 6 months. What we're trying to do there is to provide those support systems to pregnant women to help them connect with all of the appropriate local resources like local public health and our home visiting programs, to connect with local social service departments for applications and medical assistance, to connect to educational and employment opportunities. So that's a program that's designed to help pregnant women through their pregnancies. At times, what we find is a woman will come in and say that she's pregnant because she is having morning sickness. She's unable to go to work because she's in a job that has very limited sick benefits. She needs some assistance to carry her through for a month. So the rent vouchers that we're looking at through this particular program are really emergency rent vouchers that help a woman in her pregnancy for maybe a month or 2 months. They are not intended to be long-term, and our hope is that the grantee is able to connect that woman with more long-term support systems within her community.
Senator?
I appreciate the intent is to try to connect. I appreciate that, but for a lot of these women, I'm imagining the idea of an unplanned pregnancy just throws their world upside down. And frankly, a little bit of morning sickness, again, doesn't really classifies helping a woman to have a successful pregnancy outcome with a child that's healthy, and then how do you manage that care? What Are you providing a continuum? Are there special grants that are at the county level for women that have made the connection with you, and then they go in and get some sort of priority treatment? Are they given some assistance to get onto these programs quickly without, what is the continuum of care here? A connection is one thing. Giving a pamphlet is one thing, but making sure that woman has care is another.
So said.
Madam Chair, Representative, I clearly agree with you that giving a woman a pamphlet is not going to be or provide her with the assistance that she may need, which is why we tried to structure this grant program to be more aggressive in assuring that linkages do occur, that the grantee is in contact with the local public health department, can refer a family or a woman into the for a home visiting visit, for other services, that is in a position to help a woman complete a medical assistance application and get that submitted. So not only do that women just come in for the day, we're trying to embed in this particular program that follow-up does occur and that we assure that those linkages do occur in the community setting.
I think I have some more questions, but I think I'd rather see the description that you asked for, and perhaps that will help me to ask a better question. Thank you.
Representative Krantz.
I have a procedural question maybe for this committee and the Department of Health. I gather that based on your testimony, you read it from a document. Is that accurate? I guess that I'm going to ask procedurally if we can't have those documents describing these programs up front or ahead of time, and then we can save 15, 20 minutes and have the department actually come to us and say, boy, these three programs, we're seeing a high volume, we could use some assistance there, or boy, if we could get resources for this activity or that. I guess I'm feeling like we spent 15, 20 minutes on this committee, and I don't know that I'm any further along in my knowledge about what you see out there, what the needs are from the Department of Health, and how we can do our job to assist you helping the people in Minnesota. So maybe we have to go through the chair, or we have to go through the committee and decide, or even the Department of Health, but if you're going to outline programs, I would prefer to read them on my own than be read to and actually get down to business here, because we're going to start hearing bills, and I'm concerned that time is going to be important. So I guess maybe that's just a statement to both groups, but I'd like to get a feel for where the areas of importance are and how we might best meet those needs versus just hearing an overview of each of the areas. I can read that on my own. Thank you.
Any comment from the department?
Madam Chair, we'd be more than happy to provide the written testimony that we've prepared for today, and I don't know when we are scheduled to come back before this committee to talk about the proposals that the governor has recommended for the health department, and those would answer your questions about where we think additional resources are needed.
Thank you.
And I think in the meantime that if we can get those budget documents, that will be very helpful so that diligent people like Representative Krantz can actually look at them ahead of time, and we probably can move things along a little faster. Okay, there's one more person, Representative Lane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess I need some very basic understanding. When what is the Family Planning Special Projects Program actually about? I just jotted down, help low-income people prevent unintended pregnancies. I'm not sure I wrote everything you said or if that's it. And if that's it, what exactly, where did it come from, what is it involved in, and what are some of the grants that you provide out of that?
That grant program came in 1975, I think, by the state legislature. Its primary purpose is to provide low-income and high-risk women with access to family planning services. The funding that we receive for that particular area goes out in grants to either community health boards, nonprofit organizations, or tribal governments for the provision of family planning services.
When you say family planning services, could you be more expansive?
The language in the statute allows the funding to go for five primary areas. One is public information, to inform the public of reproductive health issues, for outreach to bring individuals who may need services and connect them with where low-cost services might be available, with counseling to talk with an individual on an individual basis around the variety of contraceptive services that might be available to them, to provide family planning methods, and to do any necessary medical referrals.
I see you're still questioning. Maybe we can move on and if you have another question, we can come back to you. Representative Schrumper?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Three, I think, quick questions. How many grantors are involved in the positive alternative grants?
Madam Chair, Representative, I believe there's 37 current grantees.
37 organizations that are involved. Okay. You know, some people might see the positive alternative program and the family planning program as kind of parallel. Some people might even see them as competing. Do they all, or does the department have the same standards for accountability for both the family planning services and the positive alternative services?
Okay.
Madam Chair, Representative, the department oversees our grant programs in a consistent manner. We have grant managers that do site visits, go over contract language, go over deliverables that the state is expecting to see. So the Department of Health does provide oversight in the same manner between the grant programs.
So it's consistent between the two? It'll be fairly detailed, so on? Okay.
It's consistent between the two.
I have one quick question. Madam Chair, I live in outstate Minnesota in Houston County. Do any of the PFSP funds go to providers in, or, you know, do they go to every rural county, can I ask?
Madam Chair, Representative, it does not go to every rural county. However, the Family Planning Special Project grants are distributed by formula within regions with the state, so every region within the state has access to a proportion of the dollars available. And the proportion of dollars available to them is based on the number of women within that particular region.
Okay.
All right. Representative Huntley?
Just a comment on the special project or the family plan grants. They do go all over the state. There's about $8 million a biennium currently. They're all aimed basically at women between 18 and roughly 24, the ones that use these services primarily. And for a lot of these young women just starting their lives, they don't have health insurance to start with. And they get their entire health care through these grants. That's it. They go to the family planning clinic, they get their pap smears, they get their blood pressure checked, everything else. And they obviously get the family planning stuff, and it's probably the most cost-effective healthcare system that we have. For, I don't know what it is now. 6 years ago, it was about $350 per woman getting their entire year's supply of drugs, contraceptives, rather, and also their entire year's worth of healthcare for $350. Mm-hmm. Now with the price of pharmaceuticals going up, it's more than that now. But for most of these women, this is their entire health care for a year, one visit.
Representative Schrumper?
Yeah, I guess one follow-up question from something Representative Huntley gave me. Is there a big discrepancy between requests for grants and grants awarded?
Madam Chair, okay. Representative? Generally speaking, the Department of Health does get significantly more requests for funding than is available to actually award. And in the Family Planning Special Project grant area, I think we received during the last grant cycle requests for $3 million more than what we had available to distribute.
Madam Chair, I don't exactly know where Representative Huntley got this, but it seems to be a summary of all the grants requested from various organizations around the state, and the total grants for requests our total request for grants was in the area of $13.6 million, and a total grants awarded was $7.8 million, so there was about almost a $6 million discrepancy.
Madam Chair, Representative, I think I'm talking on an annual basis, and you're talking on the two-year cycle.
Yes, you're right. 2 years. Okay, thank you.
Representative Will. Thank you, Madam Chair. We've not been talking at all about staffing for these programs, but when the grants are provided, I know that there are program costs, but embedded into that, of course, is providing staff salaries or costs. So how can you break down what is a staff cost versus a program delivery cost?
Madam Chair, Representative, it really depends on the grant program you're discussing. With Positive Alternatives, the department got $100,000 as a separate line item to do administration of that particular grant program, and $2.4 million roll out in grants annually. With the Family Planning Special Project Grant Program, all of the money that we receive goes out in grants, and we support that grant program through some federal dollars.
All right. I suppose that when we see the narrative that you're going to provide us, some of that will be broken down for us. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative, the detail actually is on page 13, and as you see each line item, we tend to separate out the amounts that are specific for grants and then amounts for FTEs that support that grant program are right there next to it. So in the column that says FTE, you can see where there are staff positions associated with grant programs.
Okay, that helps. Are you having, because of the nationwide shortage of nurses and doctors right now, are you having difficulty staffing these programs in outstate Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Representative, most of the money that we have goes out in grants, and it would be local organizations that would deal with the staffing issues. We have heard that there are some concerns and certainly some delays in being able to fill some positions.
Okay. Representative Madora.
I guess, Madam Chair, my question, I guess, then is, if we're looking at such a difference in the amount of people that are approved but unfunded, what's the plan for the department to deal with this?
Madam Chair,
I'm going back to Representative Shumpert. What's the plan to deal with that?
Madam Chair and Representative, the Family Planning Special Project Grant Program is not an entitlement program like our medical assistance program is an entitlement program. So there is nothing in statute that directs us to ensure funding available for every eligible participant. Statute simply provides an amount of funding and directs us, based on certain criteria, to award grants to those who competitively apply.
Sorry to be such a stickler. I'm sure it's the place. I just want to understand. To me, trying to fund a program that works towards preventing pregnancy is a worthwhile cause for the Department of Health. And when I look at a document like this, and there's a $6 million difference between women that are approved, and these are by your own guidelines. They are approved for the program, but there's no funding for that. And I'm not seeing that kind of an increase in this documentation. That's worrisome. And then you tell me that in this document here, that the once they have decided to continue, or if there's a discussion and the women come to you and they're trying to continue their pregnancies, they again get a crib, a car seat, and a couple of rent vouchers to cover things like morning sickness and they weren't able to work. There seems to be a big discrepancy here about what the goals of the department are, and I guess I would very much like to see that documentation of what exactly these programs cover, and really some understanding from you as to why we're not seeing these dollars into this budget. So thank you.
That was a clear request. I hope we can count on either you or the commissioner to get back to us with that. We will be following up with the commissioner soon. Representative Benson, I think, had a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, I've seen statistics before I say that. I think everybody in our state would like to see the number of unwanted pregnancies and thereby abortions reduced. And I've seen statistics, and I'd like to have you verify if they're accurate, that over the last 5 years, the number of abortions performed for low-income women in Minnesota has increased by 44%. First of all, is that an accurate number as far as you know? And I have a follow-up.
Madam Chair, Representative, I know that the total number of abortions performed in Minnesota has declined over time, but your question asked whether there are more to low income, and that piece of information I do not know, and we'll try to get back to you with that.
I appreciate that. If a statistic of 44% increase in abortions for low income women in Minnesota over the last 5 years is accurate, what impact would that have on the administration's decisions to reduce the assistance for family planning programs in our state?
Ms. Kelly? Chair, we'll have to get back to you on that and once we know what the statistic is.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
I think Representative Schumper, final short one, hopefully. Okay.
I'd like to have two other numbers, too, while you're working on numbers. Could you come up with an average amount of money spent on a participant in the Positive Alternative Grants Program versus a person participating in one of the family planning grants programs?
Madam Chair, Representative, we would be in a position to provide you with that information around family planning. The Positive Alternative Grant Program just began July 1st. We have less than 6 months' worth of data, so it may not be reflective of what we would see at the end of this year.
Okay, that's fair.
And Mr. Olson, maybe you could still provide the 6 months' worth. While you're gathering data, I guess I have another one to add to that list. Since we do have the ENABLE program listed in here, and there is an evaluation that was conducted up until 2002 on its effectiveness, I suppose, I'd be interested in actually seeing what those numbers are, and has there been a similar evaluation on, for example, the success or not of family planning or other additional programs that the department administers that deal with pregnancy prevention?
Madam Chair, I do not believe there has been an formal evaluation of the FPSP program. I can check on that and let you know. But during my tenure, I do not remember any formal evaluation occurring.
Has there been any comparison of statistics, statistical comparison of effectiveness of any of these programs?
Madam Chair, not to my knowledge, but again, I will need to talk to staff that are in the program.
Thank you very much.
To you.
Well, committee members, we've run out of time today, but I want to thank you. I want to also just make sure that you all know we will be continuing the rest of this particular part of the health department. We have still two divisions to go, administrative and the health promotion. I think it's appropriate that the commissioner will be back, and we're setting that meeting up with her. In the meantime, I wanted to just have passed out to you something that I thought you might be interested in as a result of some of our previous discussions. The Minnesota Department of Health is apparently having a number of meetings in the Southeast Metro area regarding the PFC situation, and I think there's 6 meetings that the Department of Health will be attending, and I actually I don't know if we can get any more information on that today from Ms. Kelly, but I presume that if any of the legislators here wanted to attend any of those meetings, they would be welcome, correct? Well, Mr. Stein's here, okay. And maybe you could just tell us, will the Health Department be joined by the Pollution Control Agency or any other resources in these communities?
Madam Chair, John Stein, Director for Environmental Health, Minnesota Welcome. Department of Health. Thank you. The department will be joined by Pollution Control Agency staff, local public health staff from Washington County will also attend, as well as municipal government officials and staff. The format for the meetings is there's an open house. Typically, I think 4 of the 6 meetings will have sort of an open house format for individuals to come talk to department staff about specific questions about their property and their their well, for example, if they have specific questions of that nature. And then there'll be a formal presentation a little later in the meeting, followed again by an open house format to close out to answer specific questions that residents may have.
Okay, and Mr. Stein, it looks like the one that's tonight at Eagles Watch is actually a presentation. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's a small, Madam Chair, that is a small community of that has a well of their own that supplies a number of homes. So it's actually going to be at the Denmark Township Hall, and it's pretty much just a presentation. We don't expect a large turnout. So we kind of, in those places where we are not envisioning, based on the local government's input, lower number of turnout, we're not going to set up and do the full-blown open house. We'll just pretty much have a brief presentation followed by question and answer for the residents.
And Mr. Stein, it looks like the same will be the case in Hastings on February 12th, sorry.
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
I'm sure the committee members here who might want to follow up or concerned are welcome to attend this. We may actually take the committee to have some hearings in the community. We've been requested to do so, but since you're taking the lead on this, I just wanted to let committee members know about it in case any of you wanted to go.
Madam Chair, absolutely. It's a public meeting. It's open. We encourage everyone who has questions to attend, and we're also open to other venues for discussion.
Thank you. Okay, unless there's any further business before this committee, the meeting is adjourned.